Cluse, are you ready to talk about episode 72, which we are about to re-record?
Yeah, let's do it.
Didn't see that intro coming. We recorded episode 72, and then unfortunately we had some technical difficulties on both of our sides, and we sent it over to our wonderful podcast editor, and she said no, and then we're doing it again.
Yeah, she was asking if I was recording in a different room, but actually I just used my laptop mic.
Well, and then also my computer went to screensaver, which means it stops recording. And then we just had gaps where I was. So overall, not our best episode, but that's okay because we can give it another go right now.
Going to make it better.
Exactly. So we are now 2.5 weeks or something around that removed or after the Thought for Food Summit, which if you've been seeing the Raft website, www.raftcollective.com, you may be noticing that we've been pushing several articles, several pieces of material about the Thought for Food Summit. And so we thought we would talk just a little bit about what we encountered there, what we took away from there, and some lessons for the agriculture industry, but then also various industries in general that may not have as much user empathy as we may like as designers.
So Joe, tell me, what were two designers doing at an agriculture conference?
Oh, well, Hoos, that's a very good question. There weren't just designers there, but there were also storytellers. There was a wonderful poet by the name of Peter Bickerton. That was right. I had so many problems with his name. We're going to have interviews with all these people up on the Raft website in the next week, or probably by the time this podcast is published. But so it was a conference within the agriculture industry, but the whole idea for Thought for Food is it embraces the sort of entrepreneurial and millennial sense of purpose within what you do. And so it's not just about big known entities like Syngenta or Monsanto or Bayer, but it brings together all of these students from academia. It brings together established industry players like those people I just mentioned, but it also brings together people like designers and storytellers and people from the humanities. And that's a little bit what we're going to talk about today, which I thought was one of the most interesting things from the conference.
Yeah, there were people from all over the place. There were people from over 20 different nationalities, right?
Yeah, 20, 24, and, 22, something around there, but yeah.
Yeah, and we're calling them students, some of them, but actually some of these students already had their own companies and startups all over the world that all had to do with food and creation of food and things against food waste. And it was a great place to be. There was lots of positive energy there.
So here's the topic, which we're going to dive into. Within the conference itself, there is this combination that you don't often see within agriculture industry conferences, which is a combination of the industry itself plus humanities. And that to me is what makes this conference, this summit, so special, is it brings all of these people together. And it also has, Cluse, as you just mentioned, people who are in their early 20s running IoT farming businesses, running palm oil replacement farming businesses. So it was very entrepreneurial-minded young people who were just had this sense of purpose that agriculture and the ability to supply food to the world is something much different than we perceive it at the moment.
You keep on mentioning humanities, and I think people in the U.S. will know what that means, but can you explain it a bit more?
Ah, sure. So basically, the study of people. Think in the ways that I think of it is arts, music. What else would I classify under humanities? Philosophy. So types of storytelling. I mean, like I said, storytelling, poetry. So things of that nature that are related to the human condition and aren't necessarily related to math or engineering or sciences. The aspect that is so interesting about bringing the humanities into a conference like this or into the agriculture industry is that when you think about food, every culture has this different element of what food means to the people within that area, right? And food in general is a way of celebrating culture. It is a way of bringing people together. It is a way of sharing stories, right? It is almost at its foundation a communal aspect, right? Food was this sort of this piece of nutrition, right? I eat food in order to fuel my body. But over time, food became a way to come together as a community. But what we've seen in the agriculture industry is that the way that we produce food is anything but humanistic. It is very cold. It is statistical. It is scientific. And we just had all these discussions at the conference that how did our production of food get so far away from the consumption of food, which is a very humanistic and, well, a sort of a very human element. And why are these two things so completely different when it has to do with the same product or the same topic. So within that element, I think our interview with Peter Bickerton touched on this really nicely. And he said, look, before we got into the separation of church and state between the agriculture industry and the consumption of food, you always had this combination of arts and science, which lay in the realm of philosophy. And a lot of philosophy was, you know, around trying to understand things, trying to better dig into arguments, which for a lot of designers, you can almost relate that or have an understanding of that to empathy, right? And so this is the big thing, is that when you go into the agriculture industry, there is this complete lack of empathy. And so we learned all these interesting things, like 70% of the world's food supply is produced by smallholder farmers. These are farmers with very small plots of land. They oftentimes don't have the best technology, don't have the best machinery, don't have the best equipment, but they're the ones that are supplying our, you know, 70% of the world's food. And that was a complete shock to me. I really thought that most of the world's food was provided by factory farms. And then you hear something like this and you think, how did we get so far away that the people producing these are people that, you know, their families rely on these small crops, these small, what am I thinking of, sort of land masses of crops in order to feed their family, educate their kids. And that's a very humanistic story. That's a very, sort of empathetic story to connect with, that you're connecting with these people. But yet you never, ever hear that. You never actually touch on the human element when you go out and buy your food. Buying your food, again, is this very sort of robotic process where it strips away all of that humanity. But then all of a sudden you go home and you cook the food and all of that humanity is restored. So we kept trying to figure out why this was missing and what happened.
Yeah, what I find very interesting is that there's been a trend in the US and here in Europe as well about farmers markets, right? Where on Saturday and Sunday you can go out to the market and meet an actual farmer that made that product that you're buying from them, those vegetables or those meats. And it's like sourced, locally produced, and we have to eat local as if the rest of the world is mega farms. But no, the statistic is actually quite the opposite. The rest of the world, 70% of the world's food supply is from those smallholder farmers. And that means smallholder farmers very often means family-owned businesses and knowledge being handed down over generations. There's nothing more human than the way that the bulk of our food is produced. So why do we have this layer in between that abstracts everything away?
Well, let me try to drop two little interesting nuggets here, which have been replaying over and over in my head. The first is with you, with myself, with so many people who go to these conferences, they clearly have enough money and means to go to these conferences. So we get a lot of times stuck in the developed world, right? We mm-hmm. like to... A lot of times designers will discuss about empathy, but then even within ourselves and how we talk and how we think about things, we get stuck in the developed world, not realizing how much of the world is, you know, quote unquote, developing markets or emerging markets. And that to me is also was this revelation that, wow, okay, we really need to step back and still better understand the people that we are working for. This also spurred a side mm-hmm. comment to me that this is tangential, but I'm going to go tangential for a minute, just because this is incredibly interesting to me as a little challenge for designers. You know, you hear all these things where designers will always say, oh, we have so much empathy, we know our users, all of these things. And yet you talk to every designer, a lot of them who are left-leaning in their political structure, and yet they're like, I don't know why Brexit happened. How did Trump get elected? And like, clearly there's a disconnect here. Like designers need to spend a little bit more time understanding their users, us included. Because when you see things like that, when you're like, my food comes from where now? Or Brexit happened, why? I don't understand this. Trump was elected. This can't be right. Yes, these things are right. You just don't know those people. And that's a problem, especially if you're producing software for, you know, a mass amount of people. And that goes back to the agriculture industry. If you're producing tools for farmers, and yet 70% of the farmers don't have the means to even purchase your tools, that sounds to me like a massive growth industry. That sounds to me like a massive opportunity that the agriculture industry could be taken advantage of. But, you know, I already know that they are in a way, but this is also why you see so many of these entrepreneurs coming up at Thought for Food and within emerging markets that are solving problems within emerging markets because nobody else is solving problems for them. So designers want to sit around and talk so much about how they know users. I say designers don't know users well enough, And I love things like Mark Zuckerberg's tour of the 50 states to try to get to know people a little bit better. Sure, it may be politically motivated. I don't really care. But the fact that you're taking time to try and do this and get out of your own bubble, man, more power to you and kudos to you. Because I like you, me, Hoos, everybody at Raft should be wandering around Europe if we could, if we had time, if we had the money to go and do this and go out and find out more of what's going on in different cultures. Unfortunately, we don't. I'll take a... I'll take a bit of a breather before I get to my second point of information, since that was the first. Okay. So the second point. So the first thing was that we always talk in developed nations, but maybe we need to take a step back and realize that a lot of times we are a little bit more privileged. The second little piece of nugget of information, Hoos, based on what you said, was something I had heard in an interview maybe a year ago from one of my friends, August De Los Reyes, who now works at Google. He was at Pinterest at the time, where he was saying the designer's role is the cultural API between the outside world and the inside team. And clearly, when you go into the agriculture industry, it feels like there is not enough designers in that industry to be that cultural API, which I just love that term, because you're not getting enough interface between the people who are producing all of our food and the people who are making the products to get out to those farmers. So I'll take a breath now. Hoos, take over.
Yeah, I like, though, that August called it an API, making it like a very technical term again. But you also use the word interface or maybe interpreter. And I do think designers are in a role of, at least within their job description, they have official time for understanding people who are going to use the products. Like, user research is part of your job. And for many other people, this is not part of your job to talk to the actual end users in any important way besides maybe market research or whatever. We have the chance to go deeper and we have the chance to actually communicate these things, because as a designer, you have the ability to take these stories within an organization and make these understandable and relatable for people who are going to be creating, shipping, selling the products back to the people that it's meant for.
That goes back to, and I'll pull this up as a little bit of self-promotion, to one of our cultural principles, right? The whole idea that our job is not to produce ideas, but it's to shepherd those ideas through an organization. The entire idea of coming up with an idea, the entire idea of coming up with an idea is just fundamentally, everybody can do that, right? We hold the stance that ideas are worthless because everybody has ideas. Our job and where we deliver value is the ability to get that idea produced through an organization. And in order to do that, we need to know the organization. We need to understand what makes them tick. We need to understand the political atmosphere. We need to understand how people are rewarded. But that's a key element. And for so many designers, I think they also believe that their job starts and ends with designing the product. And from our side, from the consulting side, we know our job is almost 50% designing the product and 50% making sure that product gets into the organization and makes an impact.
Yeah, and I think we just, in the innovation industry, we started overvaluing the word idea, but I think an idea is not a solution, and that's what we're talking about, because to have a solution, you need to actually also understand your problem really well. And to understand your problem really well, you need to understand who has this problem and what makes them tick and what are the ways in which you can sell it to people. Because even though something could be a solution to a physical problem, that doesn't mean that that solution will fit into the culture or will actually be understood by the end users. And this is something that we've heard at the conference over and over, right? If you're making solutions for smallholder farmers, they're all very local. So you don't think of translating it into English and then everybody gets it. No, you need to get like super local with your solutions. And maybe even the people that you're providing a product for are not literate and will not read a manual. Why does it even need a manual?
Well, what's actually beautiful with what you just said is we were talking to one of the larger agriculture companies at the conference. And we were discussing that, as you said earlier, within smallholder farmers, these behaviors are passed down through families, right? This is a family business. And, you know, the grandfather teaches the father, teaches the son. So while products have developed, behaviors have not developed. And when I was talking to this person, I won't bother to mention the name because, you know, I don't necessarily throw anybody under the bus, but they were like, I don't understand. We're giving them new instruction manuals. Why aren't they just reading the manuals? Why are they using our products wrong? And there was a clear lack of understanding between how somebody gets a product, which maybe you ship that product with the manual, but the person who buys the product is not the person who uses it. Or if they buy the product, they may not use it at the same time they get it, and they may throw away the manual. So there's all these situations where, again, right, a designer, you know, looks at the customer journey and the context and can see those things.
But come on, like, have you ever read the manual of a new car? No, it's a car. I know where the pedals are. I know where the steering wheel is. I know how this thing works. And maybe some specific features are new, but for driving a car, you're never going to read the manual on how to drive that car. So the same thing goes for, let's say, a machine for agriculture, like a spraying apparatus or whatever you use for harvesting. If it looks the same as the previous one, but slightly shinier, then you know how to use it. Why would you grab the manual?
Totally agree. And I don't want to say that, by the way, what we're talking about, where you have one element at one end of the spectrum, which is food consumption, and a very human and social and cultural element, and the way that it's produced is a very cold statistical way. Agriculture is not the only industry that this happens, right? You look at healthcare. Healthcare is fundamentally about people. And yet you go into a hospital and it could not be a more sterile, you know, just sort of cold environment. And you know, I mean, so I don't want to just jump on the agriculture industry and say, wow, this is the last industry that's really needs to catch up. No, there are many industries that are just fundamentally about people that seem to miss that whole aspect, that your job and everything surrounding you is about people, and you should look at it that way, and you should understand it in that context, not in the context. I mean, I know, especially in the US, healthcare is this booming, vibrant industry of sort of capitalistic gain. And I know over in Europe, it's not, it's not that bad. But at the same time, I've been to Dutch hospitals and they don't feel any better than American hospitals. It almost feels more factory farmed, to borrow from agriculture, where you walk into the room. You get your little whatever procedure done to remove a tumor on your arm. They stitch you up and then they're like, thank you very much, number 856. Off you go. Here's your paracetamol. Yeah,
exactly.
And there is this complete lack of treating you like a human. There is just treating you like an object that must be operated on, like you are a machine. I don't think agriculture is the only industry. I think there's a lot of industries that have a long way to go towards really empathizing with the people that they work with.
So this is why it is good to, at a conference like that, have a in-house poet that actually writes a poem about all of the things he's been seeing and saying and hearing that week. Or have a bunch of designers teach a class on how you kind of pitch a solution, right? Because maybe you have a great idea, but that doesn't mean that other people will quickly understand why it is a great idea.
Yeah, so this goes back to that humanities part, right? Don't always think of everything as statistics. Understand the role of culture. Understand the role of empathy. Understand that cultural API reference that, you know, just understand people better. If you go back to my rant earlier, if you're confused on, you know, Brexit or Trump or any of these situations where you're like, well, this seems impossible, go out and talk to more people. And if you're in the agriculture industry, if you're in the healthcare industry, look a little bit more about bringing the human element back into those industries, because I think it's going to serve you going forward. The more that we look at, whether that's millennials, whether that's Generation Z, you see a much more purpose-driven generation. And yes, you could make fun of it easily with, you know, selfie culture and, you know, all these things that you see on Instagram that we actually talk about in episode 73. So go check that out, because we recorded episode 73 a few days ago. So I think it's easy to make fun of that, but as conditions across the world have improved, you see people are searching for meaning and for purpose much more than they are searching for the base of the Maslow hierarchy of needs. And so as you get into these things, bringing that human element back, people are going to search for that. So I don't think it's just about doing this to, you know, for some reason serve people better because you're a nice person. I think it actually makes business sense for the generations to come. So Guus, is there anything you want to wrap up with? I know we're just about time here.
So yeah, in the last episode that we recorded poorly and are now redoing, we at the end actually plugged the poem that Peter Bickerton performed at the end of the conference. So I'm doing that again. We'll put a YouTube link in the show notes for this episode, and go and watch that. It's basically a wrap-up of all of the topics that passed by in a much more human way than any report or PowerPoint could.
No, and the fact that he can memorize all of that so quickly is always impressive. So we'll get all that in the show notes, and also check out our website to just see some of the articles and some of the wrap-ups and many of the different interviews we conducted at the Thought for Food Summit. So Chus, good to talk. Good to re-record. I liked this one better. I think we had a little bit more fun here.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, well, I will see you next week, man.
Bye.
Later.